I'm Scott Weinberger, journalist and former deputy sheriff. In my new podcast series, Cold Blooded, I'm embedded in the cold case investigation into the death of firefighter Billy Halpern. Experience this investigation in a truly unique way, untangling secrets that may reveal the answers to not only one case, but almost a dozen. Listen to Cold Blooded, The Apollo Gym Murders on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi guys, Nancy Grace here, host of podcast Crime Stories with Nancy Grace. I've dedicated my life to fighting crime and helping crime victims. For a decade, I prosecuted violent felonies. Every day is a mission. Every day is a chance to stop crime and keep one more person safe. Listen to Crime Stories with Nancy Grace on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcast.
In the recent history of documentary filmmaking, one scene stands out above all. The hot mic bathroom confession of Robert Durst in The Jinx. Now the person responsible for that moment, Sareb Kaufman, stepson of the victim, friend of the murderer, star of the documentary, for the first time ever, shares why he believes you're watching the furthest thing from the truth on this exclusive episode of Murder Homes. Listen to Murder Homes on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Now here's a highlight from Coast to Coast AM on iHeartRadio.
So, Harvey, that's a cool tune.
Listen, I'm just, it's in a world where we have so much variety, whether it be rap music or EDM or singer-songwriter, ballads, acoustic music. Something happens when you kind of hear a raucous rock and roll, you know, Chuck Berry-inspired riff. Even his bumper music.
Yeah.
It kind of, things start jumping a bit.
Yeah, and it builds.
And I haven't felt that way on the Rolling Stones albums. For the live thing is a different scenario.
Right.
I haven't felt, you know, maybe close to them in the audio world. I'm talking product for a very long time. And maybe I'm rejoining the fan club a bit, you know? And I guess you feel the same way too.
I do. And what I caught myself doing was hitting replay on that tune. And I'm like, I want to hear it again.
And that's
been a while.
I do want to amplify one other thing, and not because I'm a child of Hollywood, but when the Stones come to town and record in Hollywood, like some of the new record on Sunset Boulevard at the studio.
Right.
I think a lot of people forget, maybe that's my job is on the expedition, that literally, I don't know, 90% of their recordings from 1964 to 1967 were done on Sunset Boulevard, where a lot of the new record was done at this studio. They did a lot of their seminal albums with the producer Andrew Lou Goldham at RCA Studios, and then they did Bridges to Babylon in the same facility. And so there is the influence of Hollywood and Sunset Boulevard. And I mean, I've always said that the Rolling Stones records, could you imagine if the albums you cherish from 64 to 67, that little block, imagine if they were recorded in New York instead of the flexibility and the environmental graphic of Hollywood and Sunset Boulevard. The setting, the bioregional environment, does play a part in what we eventually hear. And I think some of that has seeped in this new recording.
You know, you remind me of the conversation around the Tammy show.
Well, I'm the expert on that one.
So I'm going to turn you on that, because I think it's still a lot of people don't know about this, but it still pops up a little bit, like in the biopic with James Brown, and you know, as legend goes, the band was still in 1964 when it first toured America. They hadn't even had a hit right on American radio. They were kind of obscure. I think didn't Bill Wyman or somebody describe it as an absolute disaster, the first tour of the United States.
You know, there's a lot of myths about that. And listen, I was 12 years old across the street from the Santa Monica Civic Auditorium.
Shut up.
You know, at a surfboard shop. I did not know what was going down, although I sure noticed a lot of girls wearing short skirts. I was too busy with my surfer pal longboarder, Peter Piper, buying paraffin wax for our con surfboards. I actually had a Makaha skateboard. I didn't know what was going on, but in the 50 years of reporting and interviewing everybody associated with the Tammy Show, director, producer, band members, choreographers, you know, and Sting references it in one of his songs as well with the police. Let's just be really clear that it was a two-day shoot with a rehearsal. It was sort of, shall we say, like all Hollywood movies, because
right.
I've been on a lot of film sets. It's shot out of sequence. And so, you know, even the order of what we see on DVD now or on TV, that's not, with the exception of the hosts, Jan and Dean, I mean, sure, the, you know, the Stones, James Brown, the Stones had to follow James Brown, but, you know, there was an hour to wait, or there was a lot of break time to set up equipment and things like that. It isn't this situation as perceived by all of us.
Right.
What counts is the product that impacts us. And the genius work of Jack Nitzsche as the musical director of the Tammy Show. I just have been in the studio with a wonderful guitarist, Don Peake. He did 10 years with Ray Charles. He's on a lot of the Jackson 5 records. He did many years with Barry White. Don Peake is in both the Tammy Show band in the orchestra.
Right.
He's also in the big TNT show. Which is kind of this sister element,
sister right.
to the Tammy Show. So I have talked extensively with these people. And last time I was on your show, when I was touting my book on music documentaries, Roxette Doc, you know,
right.
we talked about the Tammy Show and some of these things. And so I've made it a point to talk to the participants. And, you know, they have their own stories. The truth is often in the middle, but it does work. And both Mick Jagger, you know, has told the story that he actually had to sort of do some ministry work with James Brown when it was explained to James Brown, listen, you know, we're going to be kind of following you. And even Mick said, you know, it's kind of shot out of the sequence. It's going to be a put together project. I don't think James Brown was having any of that, but I actually think, and I've talked to Jack Nitzsche, you know, the late Jack Nitzsche, extensively about the Tammy Show, and he thought James Brown opening, if you want to use that term for the Rolling Stones, or them following his act. With James, it was an act, it was life on stage, that he thought it inspired the Rolling Stones to take it to another level. And you know, for all of us as consumers, guess what? We like both of them, James Brown and the Rolling Stones and the Motown acts and Jan and Dean. And it's such a time capsule of a rock and roll, isn't it?
I'm Scott Weinberger, journalist and former deputy sheriff. In my new podcast series, Cold Blooded, The Apollo Gym Murders, I'm embedded in the cold case investigation into the death of firefighter Billy Halpern.
It's just a shame, you know, that they took him from us.
Experience this investigation in a truly unique way, knocking on doors, uncovering new evidence, including the DNA of a potential killer.
My name is Danny Smith. I'm a detective with the Miramar Police Department. This is Scott Weinberger. We're actually reopening an old case, and your name came up.
Untangling secrets that may reveal the answers to not only one murder, but almost a dozen.
I thought they were going to kill me, so I kept my mouth shut, and I didn't say anything. All these years, I didn't say anything.
Listen to Cold Blooded, The Apollo Gym Murders on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
In the recent history of documentary filmmaking, one scene stands out above all. The hot mic bathroom confession of Robert Durst in The Jinx. Now the person responsible for that moment, Sareb Kaufman, stepson of the victim, friend of the murderer, star of the documentary, for the first time ever, shares why he believes you're watching The Furthest Thing from the Truth on this exclusive episode of Murder Homes. Listen to Murder Homes on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, girlfriends, it's me, Carol Fisher. I'm so excited to tell you about the brand new series of The Girlfriends. In season one, we told you about the murder of Gail Katz at the hands of my ex-boyfriend, Bob. At one point, a woman's torso washed up on Staten Island and was misidentified as Gail. She spent 9 years in Gail's grave, and then she just disappeared.
It's almost like it's become this moral obligation to find her.
And that's what we're going to do. Find this missing girlfriend and tell her story. With the help of some of your favorite girlfriends from season one, like my producer, Anna.
Oh, my God.
My friend, Dr. Mindy Shapiro.
Hi, it's Dr. Shapiro, and I'd like to speak with the deputy medical examiner.
And, of course, Gail's sister, Elaine Katz.
Having no closure, it kills you.
Join us as we try to solve a 35-year-old cold case. It's not going to be easy, but it's going to be one hell of a ride.
What?
I can't believe this.
Listen to season two of The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister, starting May 6th on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Well, I don't want to go over the old ground that we tackled last time, but I will say what I like most about the story, sorry, is that Mick Jagger got his comeuppance, if that part of the story is true, of James Brown telling Mick Jagger, follow that. Because he knows that, you know, Jagger had been ripping off a lot of his moves. And nobody did it better than the original hardest working man in show business. So, I mean, I look at that and I say, I hope that part of the story is true. I do know that, as you have said before in the past, that I think maybe it wasn't you, but somebody said that, I mean, didn't they regret doing it? I mean, wasn't it like many of the Stones performers were like, that was a huge mistake to try and go on that stage?
Sort of, but the interesting thing is the bands, everybody who participated, it was a package deal and everybody got paid quite handsomely in 1964 fees.
What would be a 1964?
I think every person involved, I'm talking every act, got yeah. $25,000 each.
Wow.
Now, they did surrender all the rights then.
Wow.
I'm talking about product, television,
sure.
Movie exhibition.
That is a ton of money back then, though.
It was put together by GAC, General Artists Corporation, kind of the booking agent. And so even, shall we say, the other people on the band, the groups, besides the Stones and James Brown and the Motown artists, so everybody got a nice payday, and here they are at the beach in Southern California. So I don't think anybody regretted anything about that. And sometimes when you have that baptism by fire, look, the Stones I'm sure it helped fuel their records that they were recording on Sunset Boulevard at RCA right after that, or when they did extra touring. And then the Stones, and by the way, Mick Jagger had watched Little Richard probably 30 times on a 1963 tour with the Everly Brothers. Don Peake and I were talking about this. So he was already looking at Ike and Tina Turner and Motown music and Little Richard. And, of course, you know, he went to the Apollo before or after to go see James Brown. But he's never hidden the fact that the influences he wore on his sleeve. And eventually he became his own performer after soaking up the DNA of these legends.
But, okay, let me just fundamentally, since you know the Tammy show, and for people who don't, it's worth looking at and it's worth looking into because it's so fascinating. And did we ever agree on what exactly Tammy, T-A-M-I?
Well, Teenage American Music International.
Okay.
That's
right.
Kind of where it comes from. But I've interviewed the director, Steve Bender, a couple of times. But, you know, because I know his history, and he went to L.A. High School, and he's another native Angeleno. I mean, Steve had worked on a show called Jazz Scene USA in, like, 60 and 61. So his blocking techniques or his directorial style, it came from jazz and improv, but he also knew how lights were working, and he knew to bring in the choreographer, David Winters, and also Tony Bassel. So there was choreography and dance and energy and impulse, and also it was so well done. Plus, it was in a new kind of film stock called Electronavision, which was short-lived. It's, if you've ever seen the movie Harlow, it was kind of a different, the direct, it was sort of like you shoot it on video and then you put it back to like film.
Oh, yeah.
So it's a different kind of black and white film experience. It didn't last long due to, it was kind of expensive, but that was something developed from TV station KTLA out here. So the film stock is even, it plays a part, again, like I was talking earlier about the studios and room tone and the environmental aspect. It even brings you in a little deeper, maybe. Although it's all been transferred now and highlighted on DVD and Blu-ray, and it's a little different. But it was not your traditional shoot quick black and white concert footage of a rock and roll band and lip sync. It really was a 2.5-day kind of concert experience that we got to see in theaters. And then it disappeared for a long time because there was no video outlets. There was no VCRs. There was no DVDs. Then it came back, and now it's a really good discovery for anybody
who wants
to see that era.
And to see Terry Garr, right, dancing in the background.
Hello, with Tony Bassel.
Yeah,
Anita Mann's in there, too.
Oh, but, really?
I mean, it was a thriving, throbbing Los Angeles experience, and it kind of bleeds into the things that Jack would do the following year when he brought a Shindig on television.
Right.
I mean, it all comes from
it. Yeah, I can see that.
See the correlation.
But is it not true, then, though, that the Stones insisted on going last, and that's what the regret is that they should have been more respectful of James Brown and the energy that he brought to a stage, regardless, as you say, whether or not there was an hour's gap for resetting cameras and lights or whatever, that they recognize, even if the story's not true about, you know, James Brown passing Mick Jagger in the wings, saying to him, yeah, go on top that, that it was still that was still the Stones' choice, that they were the last act, and as maybe at the time they feel like they really hadn't earned that yet.
Well, you know what? Part of me agrees with you, but part of me bends to Jack Nitzsche, the musical director who knew the Rolling Stones and brought them in and said to Steve Bender, they're hot, they're going to be huge, they do roots music. And I think Jack told me more than once, he suggested or determined the order because he knew, let's start it off with some surf music or pop vocal, you know, Jan and Dean. Let's take everybody through some other English groups early on, Jerry and the Pacemakers,
right.
Billy J. Kramer. Let's let the Motown artists, whether it be the Supremes or of course, Marvin Gaye, let's let Chuck Berry kick it off pretty early to set up the Stones, and Chuck Berry is their ancestral godfather.
Right.
I think Jack really set it up that way. The Stones and management and their record label probably didn't have the clout or power in 1964 to demand this kind of stuff. I think it just kind of worked out that way, but Jack Nitzsche saw the promise of the Rolling Stones very early. And, you know, he probably liked to put them into a baptism by fire thing. And by the time they played the show and it was taped. And by the time they started playing, they took off. And Jack Nietzsche's told me in two different books, when the Stones appeared, it was a new type of emotion. Now, I don't know if he was comparing or contrasting James, you know, James's gig. And James was otherworldly. But the Stones at least held their mud pretty much, and it was not a disaster. And I think as we look at it now, I'm just glad we have Brian Jones on screen and we can see that original band at that moment.
Not stoned out of his mind like he was doing Sympathy for the Devil or whatever. It was that other thing that he was, you could see him in.
Where he was quite passive, shall we?
Yeah, let's just say he was passive. Okay, so that's the Tammy show. Do you have photos in this book, Rolling Stones Icons, from that period? I didn't.
I know there's 1964 photos, but there there was probably some rights issues where they couldn't license some things. But there are, you know, pictures from 1964, and there are, you know, pictures from the Rock and Roll Circus and you know, some of their television appearances. But I think what happened with this book, and it happens largely, I think, with the Stones, is we are, maybe you and I are a bit different than some people in your listenership, somehow most of the Stones photos end up being live stage shots.
Oh, okay.
You know, as opposed to, because photographers and studios, you know, people weren't taking a lot of pictures of rock and roll bands in studios in 64. They might have been a set person or somebody aligned with a television station. Nobody was carrying a lot of their own photographers in that 63-64 world. That's why we're very grateful when we see early Motown acts and some of those people, because you don't see tons of the photos then.
Listen to more Coast to Coast AM every weeknight at 1 a.m. Eastern and go to coasttocoastam.com for more.
I'm Scott Weinberger, journalist and former deputy sheriff. In my new podcast series, Cold-Blooded, I'm embedded in the cold case investigation into the death of firefighter Billy Halpern. Experience this investigation in a truly unique way, untangling secrets that may reveal the answers to not only one case, but almost a dozen. Listen to Cold-Blooded, The Apollo Gym Murders on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi guys, Nancy Grace here, host of podcast Crime Stories with Nancy Grace. I've dedicated my life to fighting crime and helping crime victims. For a decade, I prosecuted violent felonies. Every day is a mission. Every day is a chance to stop crime and keep one more person safe. Listen to Crime Stories with Nancy Grace on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcast.
In the recent history of documentary filmmaking, one scene stands out above all. The hot mic bathroom confession of Robert Durst in The Jinx. Now the person responsible for that moment, Sareb Kaufman, stepson of the victim, friend of the murderer, star of the documentary, for the first time ever, shares why he believes you're watching the furthest thing from the truth on this exclusive episode of Murder Homes. Listen to Murder Homes on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.